History is meant to be the story of all of us, the definitive human story. But it isn't, and it never was. History, in the end, is the story of those who wrote it. They own it. This is In Search of Black History with Bonnie Greer, an Audible original. I'm a playwright, an author, a critic, and a former deputy chair of the British Museum, one of the great repositories of our shared, our blended, our still evolving human story. For me, history is a journey, a process, a point of view, and because of that, there are large chunks of it that are still hidden. In this series, I'm going to show you the hidden, the laid aside, the unheard, the vanquished, the erased. I'll be revealing people whose lives have been written out, distorted, forgotten, people who tell us a different tale about who we all really are. Whatever you've taken for granted as being Black history, well, you can leave that outside the door. In this series, you're going to hear things you have probably never heard before. I want to share this with you. I want to show you. My goal? To blindside you. So get ready, because you're going to discard, like I have, most of everything you know and most of everything you feel about one of the great disruptors of our human story, the phenomenon known as Black history. Episode 1, Prehistory. The bones never lie.
If you went back to that time period, you wouldn't necessarily see anybody who behaved or looked like us, but we see the sort of earliest physical and behavioral manifestations of people like us around 300,000 years ago in Africa.
What ancient DNA particularly has done is completely demolish that idea of old racial theories.
I cannot tell an American story better than an American. Neither can I tell the European story, the English story better than the Englishman. So the first point is that we are telling our stories from our perspective.
Come with me. I want to take you to one of the places I hold closest to my heart, the British Museum, to explain why I'm making this series in the first place. I'm standing in front of my favorite object at the British Museum, and one that means a lot to me. It's called the Akan drum, and I'm going to read what it says. The Akan drum was made in what is now Ghana. The drum, which was collected in Virginia in about 1730, is related to the transatlantic slave trade and is a rare survival from this period. It's assumed that the drum was used to sort of soothe and calm the abductees on their voyage over to the New World or to wherever they thought they were going to go. And why this matters to me, of course, is not only the fact that this is arguably so far the oldest African-American object in any museum anywhere, but it's about being here in the West. It's about being the descendant of enslaved Africans, and actually, in a way, I feel like this object, this beautiful drum, came with me, and it really
is so much about how I feel about history and who I am. I think in a way this drum accompanied my ancestors here, and that it being here is a sort of comfort and assurance for me. I just love her. She's very, very modestly placed. The gallery is low lit because the artifacts can't use a lot of light. People would ask me why I even would be in this place. I got a lot of pushback from people when I was appointed to the board. People would tell me, how could you even come in here, let alone sort of be a part of this? And I would always come here to the drum to ask her, well, what's the answer to that? And she'd say, because I'm here. And so I'm here because she's here. So that's the best explanation that I can give about why I'm here and why this place means something to me. I'm the first woman of color to be a deputy chair of this place, first woman of African descent. And I'm standing with my friend, Professor Olivette Otele, who is the first woman of color and certainly the first woman of African descent to be made a full professor of history in this country. And she's professor at Bath Spa University, and she's my good mate. We're standing here looking at this in some ways problematic and emotional situation, because on a certain level, you can say this drum is captured as well. So it's not an easy thing to talk about.
No, it's not. The full circle is the history of enslavement in one drum. It's leaving Africa, doing that horrendous crossing, arriving in the Americas, living all sort of things, and then being taken by the colonizer to be exposed and to be shared, but captured in a box, you know. But having said that, 21st century Europe, Britain, is actually quite grateful to see that drum here, because we can tell the story back and we can relate and we can have that kind of relationship with the past. It's both emotional, it's brutal, but this is our lives. These are our lives, actually.
One of the things that is so moving for me is that we can now, I think, in the 21st century, uncover some of the truths that may be very painful about this thing called Black history, that may be very surprising, that people may push back against because it destroys their own mythology in their head. And it's one of the things I want to explore is the mythology of Black history and break it open so that we can get to the truth, because we can't get to truth and reconciliation until we know the full truth.
Yes, completely agree. And I'm stunned by the fact that we position ourselves quite often in terms of 21st century victims and perpetrators. The victim side, I understand that, you know, the legacies of the past include financial legacies that a whole group of people did not have access to. But people of African descent are not victims in the sense that they were resilient. They fought for agency, and we continue to fight for that agency. So for me, this podcast is really about reinscribing all these positive elements into our own history. It was messy, but we fought against it, and that is why we're still here.
That is why we're still here. And that legacy goes right back to our earliest glimmerings of humankind in the prehistoric world, the world before the written word. At this time, most early humans were in Africa. It was ancient climate change, population explosions, the impact of the natural world, which caused us to move, which kept us apart, and which led us to ourselves. People were using the very, very beginnings of tools. This was before agriculture. But the earliest art, traces of how early humans felt and thought of the world, can still be found if you look. Back then, at least 300,000 years ago, the diversity of our early human ancestors was so enormous that it makes the differences we perceive between our fellow human beings today seem mighty trivial, and it raises the question, what exactly is race? Does race really exist? That is where we're going to start our quest with who are we really? To answer that question, we spoke to Dr. Eleanor Sherry, Associate Professor in Archaeology at the Max Planck Institute for the Science of Human History in Germany.
There is indisputable evidence that Homo sapiens, people like us, originated in Africa. Now, when that happened, it's still something that's starting to be uncovered. And we've been pushing that back further and further and further in time because evolution is a continuous process. So there's really not a point where you're not a human and the next day you are a human. So with that caveat, based on our understanding of the DNA sequence from Neanderthals and ancient DNA sequence from people like us, we think that the lineages began to split sometime between 750,000 years ago and 500,000 years ago. So the earliest glimmerings, if you like, of our species is around that time. Now, if you went back to that time period, you wouldn't necessarily see anybody who behaved or looked like us, but we see the sort of earliest physical and behavioral manifestations of people like us around 300,000 years ago in Africa.
They didn't look like us, but they were us. Modern humans emerged around 300,000 years ago in Africa. That might be something you already know. But actually, it's only been accepted knowledge since we developed the ability to sequence DNA in the 1980s. Before that, the idea that modern humans came from one ancestral line and that line came from Africa was controversial. Debate was split between the out-of-Africa theory and another theory called multi-regionalism. Multi-regionalism argues that modern humans in each part of the world had descended separately from different early human ancestors. So this is the idea. Europeans descended from one early human, Asians from another, Africans from yet another, and so on and so forth. Some of these ideas were just scientists testing theories, which were later disproved. But the persistence of this theory, even in the face of the fact that our common African origins have been proven, is rooted in a point-blank refusal to see our common humanity. And that's called racism. The out-of-Africa theory is settled. But investigating the reasons why human beings left Africa is still too often mired in an unconscious, inherited, colonial approach.
So understanding how humans like us originated and ultimately how we ended up colonizing every corner of the earth is a major question of interest. But we tend to fall into a lot of traps when asking questions. And one of these is a sort of out of Africa question. Out of Africa almost suggests that Africa emptied itself. And it is a major question of interest to ask how a species that was exclusively African for most of our prehistory ended up living mostly in Asia, which is where most people live today, is a valid and a very interesting question. But we shouldn't frame it in terms of when did people leave Africa. Humans expanded their ranges before they ever left Africa. They moved into different regions of Africa and people stayed in Africa. So people never left Africa. They just expanded their range. So that's a major point to make. And I think when we talk about out of Africa, it's almost like the end of our interest in African history. Because we know humans came from Africa, we only seem to be interested in asking questions about the African chapter of our history until some of those people started to leave the continent.
Therefore, Africa only existed and exists in relation to Europe. For many, Black history only exists in relation to the European world. It doesn't exist outside of that. But out of Africa does not mean the end of Africa. Early humans didn't migrate to Asia, to Europe, and never look back. They moved back and forth between continents, and there was huge development and diversity within Africa itself. This was all hundreds of thousands of years ago. We've moved on. So why does it matter now how we interpret our history? Dr. Sherry says, actually, it's crucial.
Much of the study of prehistory has been dominated by this idea that Europe was the seat of all human achievement in the past, and Africa was very much situated at the periphery of that. And I think that the colonization processes in Africa used this to justify the colonization movement. And although over time, of course, these things have been recognized and to a certain degree rectified, I think a lot of the ideas have been quite pernicious. Ideas like some parts of Africa are not important, or at least Africa is only important for what it can tell us about the origin of Europeans. I think there's a lot of people who might be appalled at the idea that some of their research questions are to some extent based in these ideas, but I think it's hard to understand how these ideas can persist because we inherit research questions from the people that teach us. We don't necessarily think about where these ideas come from. We just accept them as important. And it's not always easy to see how some old ideas might be affecting the way we think now.
Academic research is largely based on interpretation of research from the past. If that historical research is discovered to be flawed, the researcher can either try to correct it or just go with the flow. If you want to challenge settled knowledge and you want to question it, you're taking a risk. And most people do not take risks, but some do. In 2018, Dr. Sherry led a team that published a paper that shook the field. She and her team wrote that contrary to all the studies to date, we did not stem from a single ancestral population of early humans coming only from East or Southern Africa. Instead, the paper said, our African ancestors were diverse in form and diverse in culture and scattered across the entire continent and living in vastly different environments. Over many thousands of years, some of those populations mixed and moved. Others remained isolated for a while, just like we are today. It was through these patterns of mixing or isolation that at some moment in time, human beings, us, began to appear.
How we think about these things can often be greatly simplified just because we're talking about huge timescales, and it sort of makes sense to think of humans as originating in one place at one time, but that's not necessarily the case. The process of becoming human, becoming modern, took place over a long time, and it happened in different places. So we have populations scattered across Africa that come into contact with each other at different times and in different parts of the continent because these populations are dynamic. They're moving around, they're changing size. Sometimes they're kept apart by environmental barriers or even physical barriers like mountains. Africa is huge. And it's somewhere within those patterns of mixing and those processes of mixing that we start to emerge. And we have to remember that people like us, so current populations in the world today, are actually quite a relatively recent phenomenon. So most of the genetic changes we carry today have originated in the last few thousand years. So nobody living today had anybody who would have even looked like them, say, 10,000 years ago.
In other words, think of a baby. Think of an infant. Think of yourself. You don't have the same face you had when you were 3 or 7 or 11 or 16, do you? And yet, you're still a member of your family.
We see this throughout human prehistory. There are these huge turnovers in, I guess, the human makeup. So while we are human all along, and we have been human for all this time, we would have been dramatically different in different makeups. So, for example, the geneticist David Reich says that people were so different at different points that today you would consider them different races. Of course, races don't exist, but the point he tries to make is that these populations looked very different from each other, and those changes kept changing themselves. So if there's any argument against race, it's probably that.
The argument is within your own family. Think about it. You're all still related, but you all look different, don't you? On the one hand, we feel attachment to our early human ancestors. They are in all of us. We want to identify. But on the other hand, we cannot put a modern human face on these people, because that is to distort evolution. But with DNA sequencing, and if you're lucky enough to find the right skeletal remains, you can put a face on some of our ancestors. A face does evolve. The man whose face shows us exactly how limited, how fixed in our own time our ideas of race are, is known to us as Cheddar Man. In 1903, workmen digging in a cave in Cheddar in southwest England uncovered a skeleton. It turned out to be 10,000 years old. This is the oldest complete human skeleton found in Britain, and it is still teaching us today. About 60 years ago, which isn't that long ago, our image of Cheddar Man was of a cartoon caveman. This wasn't a joke. This image was held by scientists. Then something amazing happened. With modern DNA analysis, another picture of the evolving Cheddar Man story has come forward. And this is the latest. And the evidence is that Cheddar Man may have had ice blue eyes and black skin. This guy, who died 10,000 years ago, lived in the Mesolithic or Middle Stone Age before farming, a hunter-gatherer. This man is the ancestor of many northern Europeans. Dr. Tom Booth is one of the team of researchers who investigated Cheddar Man's DNA.
He's the oldest complete skeleton that we have from Britain. We have other human skeletal remains from Britain that are earlier than this, but they tend to be just bits and pieces of bone, whereas he is more or less a complete skeleton. And he's been radiocarbon dated, and his radiocarbon date suggests that he died around 10,000 years ago. So measuring his bones, you can figure out that he was probably about 5'6" tall, which seems short now, but was probably about average for back then. He was definitely based upon the skeleton male as well. The work that I was involved in was extracting DNA from the skeleton and using that DNA to then look at his ancestry and also look at genetic variants that we know are associated with physical characteristics in modern populations, so things like eye colour, hair colour, skin colour. So when we looked at some of the main genetic variants that we know in modern populations are associated with skin pigmentation, we put it through this model that's used in forensics to allocate fairly crude but fairly reliable ranges as to what people's skin pigmentation was likely to be. And Cheddar Man came back as having quite dark skin, so the categories were kind of dark to black skin, which is quite a wide range, but certainly it suggested that his skin pigmentation would have been darker than what we typically think of it in Europe currently. But despite that, he did have the main genetic variant that is associated with lighter coloured eyes. So that would be anything from blue-green to hazel coloured eyes.
It's very moving to me that we can see someone's face from so long ago, and that he looks so different from modern Europeans, yet he is their ancestor.
How dark his skin came back as was quite a surprise. But we already knew to some extent that he was likely to have had fairly dark skin, and that's what we did, was apply this other method to see sort of quite how dark it was. So we know that Cheddarman's not a one-off. Essentially, the population that was inhabiting all of Europe at this time, around 10,000 years ago, probably would have had quite variable skin pigmentation, but generally darker, in some cases much darker than what we think of in terms of northern European populations today. So the point about Cheddarman and his population is that they actually exist totally outside of modern genetic variation today. They're a population that essentially doesn't exist anymore. So in terms of, you think of ideas about race and ethnicity, they belong to something that is completely outside those ideas, completely unclassifiable, really.
10,000 years ago, the science proves that Northern Europeans were not white as we think of white today. And Cheddarman was not a one-off. He shows us the face of our ancestors and gives the lie to the idea of race. The science is there. The science is settled. And Cheddarman shows us that our European ancestors from thousands of years ago, with their pale eyes and dark skin, don't fit our contemporary categories of race. Those combinations of characteristics that were long thought permanently fixed, well, those just didn't exist then.
So it's demolished the idea of there being pure populations in that sense that have been diverged for millions of years and form the basis of the kind of vernacular racial categories that we have today. What ancient DNA particularly is showing, that almost everywhere the population that inhabits an area currently is almost never the population that was always there in the past. There's never a situation where there's been the same population inhabiting the same place for tens of thousands of years. So that concept of these populations living in splendid isolation just isn't there anymore. What's more is that it becomes clear that actually every population is actually a mix of very diverse populations that have mixed in the past. So European populations are mainly a mixture of three ancestral populations that mixed at different times in prehistory, and each one of these populations is as different from each other as populations living on different continents are today.
That's our face of Cheddarman for now, because his story is evolving. And tomorrow, who knows what he'll be? We're learning more and more all of the time. So what do we know about early human origins? Well, we know that at that time in Africa, populations of early people were moving and growing. But most of our understanding comes from one small part of a vast continent. Let's return to Dr. El Nersheri, who for a long time has been fascinated by the role West Africa has in our early human development, a role that not many have looked at before.
So we want to look into this evolution in Africa more deeply. Currently, most of the work in Africa looking at human evolution has tended to take place in East Africa and Southern Africa. But the question to ask is, do we find all the fossils here because that's only where people have looked? Is it something real about human prehistory that these areas were important for human evolution? And the only way to test that is to look at all regions of Africa equally and invest that time and resources that we have looking at all areas of Africa. But what we want to do is to investigate the western regions of Africa, so just think the northwest quadrant, and try to understand what evolutionary processes are going on there. Are they the same as what we see in eastern and southern Africa? Are they different? Are the sequences of cultural change the same? Do we have evidence of very different populations living there? Is it just people like us, or are they maybe even mysterious, archaic humans still living there that we don't yet know about? I think it's all to be discovered, really. There's lots of very interesting hints and whispers of things going on in West Africa that might be different from what we see in Eastern and Southern Africa, but certainly I think looking in any new area is going to change things.
Change. That's the key. Dr. Sherry says we only have evidence for a fraction of our human history.
We know almost nothing about human evolutionary processes in Western Africa. And just to indicate how little we know, we have fossil data from about 10% of Africa. So that means we're making biological extrapolations for about 90% of the continent at the moment. So yes, those fossils are very, very interesting, very rich, but there's huge, huge parts of Africa we have almost no information. And I want to go out and find information from these poorly understood areas to see, well, do the current theories stand up to scrutiny?
Dr. Sherry is leading a brand new series of digs with an international team across Nigeria, Senegal, and Benin. And this will happen over the next 5 years. It's a partnership with local archaeologists leading the investigations. Dr. Sherry says it was hard to get the funding to set up the project. Why? Much of the settled opinion was that West Africa had contributed very, very little to the story of human history. Now, I want you to think about this. This is the acknowledged place of origin of our species, and 90% of it in relation to that has not even been explored. And let me say it another way. We only know 10% of what we know about us. One of the local scientists setting the research agenda on this project is Dr. Imwobosa Orijemi from the University of Ibadan in Nigeria.
The whole essence of this project, which is AWARE, that's the acronym for our project, the Ancient West Africa Role in Human Evolution. We know that many parts of Africa have enjoyed human evolution research, particularly eastern, southern, and northern Africa. But West Africa seems to be a blank. I mean, people don't think that human evolution in West Africa is a sexy topic. So we are trying to fill that gap. But there is still quite a lot we can learn from West Africa. And so that's why we are setting this all up. So that's the main thrust of it. And we hope that we are going to get something very fantastic.
Dr. Orijemi believes that West Africa is a treasure trove of human evolution, of human history. The exciting part about all of this is that we're just beginning to tap into it.
The first thing I would love to see happen is this. There is this site in Nigeria called Iwo Eleru. It has produced the oldest human remains so far. It was initially dated to 12,000, but it's been extended to 18,000. But we don't know what kind of environment that human being or that group of human beings existed. We don't know the kind of food resources that they exploited. So for me, that is the kind of research I would love to get starting with. So to know the kind of environment that they lived in 18,000 years ago, 12,000 years ago, 10,000, and what kind of food resources, what kind of plant resources were they exploiting? What kind of animals were they exploiting? The second fantastic thing would be to recover other set of human remains. It would be explosive. Because the general narrative so far in West Africa is that the soils are acidic, they quickly attack skeletal remains, and then the skeletal remains disintegrate. But if we can find one or two or three preserved in very good conditions, I mean, that would be a game changer. You know, so that would be fantastic for us.
And this is what I mean when I say that the story of our human history is evolving and why it's a search, especially Black History's chapter of it. For Dr. Elnor Sherry especially, it's important that we apply new tests, that we have new angles, that we bring on the excluded, the marginalized, the hidden, the unspoken, the thing that unsettles our own theories, and that African archaeologists are able finally to tell those stories themselves.
I think it's a good decolonization of archaeology program to give the lead to people living in their respective regions and give them the opportunities to be able to lead these investigations. So you've already spoken to some of my colleagues. I think it's fantastic. They're doing great work. They know where the best places to look are. They're obviously very familiar with everything that's been published locally. And so they will be spearheading the field campaigns in Nigeria, in Senegal, and in Benin to start with. And also in the meantime, I'm a research institution. We will be looking at climate change over the last 500,000 years to try to understand how people might have moved around the landscape. And then we can use this work to generate new hypotheses about human evolution that can be tested against the genetic data as well. So that's something that we'll probably do in about 4 or 5 years.
Decolonization, the stripping away of the long-held privileged place of Western colonial ideology so that Indigenous expertise and voices finally have a place, can only make research more rigorous and bigger. See, I think decolonization, at its deepest level, is about taking away your own expectations, your own needs, your own explanation, your own defense, and looking with fresh eyes at what might not affirm your thesis. Your thesis can be a good one or a bad one, but science is about fact, and our job is to be vigilant about how a fact is interpreted, who it's interpreted for, and how it is used. And the reality is that a fact leads to another fact, leads to another fact, leads to another fact, and finally to the fact that just may change what we know about ourselves today. And what we know about ourselves may not come from us. Dr. Orijemi again.
Of course, you know that archaeology was introduced to the African continent by mainly Europeans and Americans. So they tend to detect the pace. And even now, they tend to detect the pace in terms of research. Sometimes Africans are just brought in as appendages. To me, it's not right. It's not right. This is why this project is very different. The African colleagues are co-principal investigators, which goes on quite well with us. So you see that several discoveries done in archaeology in Nigeria, in Africa, most of the credit goes to European researchers. You know, those Africans or Nigerians who were part of the project because they were not there from inception. They didn't conceptualize the idea. They didn't have a say in some of the papers where they were published, the kind of ideas that were being pushed forward. And they didn't also have control in terms of training students. I think that was where we were really at a disadvantage. But now I can bring on my students to be trained. And I'm not looking just at myself because I won't be here forever. We got to look at people who will take over from us. In fact, we got to look at people who might even be better than us.
This is the voice of a true scientist, forward with research to the truth. Truth is a big table. And everybody's got to sit at it. Only then can we approach the story of who we are. And so our search for the earliest human ancestors is not only for meaning, it's for inclusion too.
I have read about American stories while I was a boy. I read about many Alexander the Great leaders and all that, but that is not my story. I cannot tell an American story better than an American. Neither can I tell the European story, the English story, better than the Englishman. So the first point is that we are telling our stories from our perspective. And this is very key. Because it's a global ancestry, because Africa is the cradle of human civilization. But, you know, we are making our own headlines, making our own stories. I think that is key.
As a playwright, I know this. We are a storytelling species. We know what we know because we tell each other stories. And the important thing is this. We have to get the story right. We have to get the story straight. If you take away anything from this series, it should be that the notion of race, as most people use it, is a nonsense. It is a construct, and that people's lives have been enhanced or destroyed by the notion of it. The fixed idea that we're divided by race has absolutely no basis in science or in fact. We have lived our lives and written our history through this absurd and destructive prism. And to show how this prism has distorted history itself, our next episode takes us to ancient Greece and Rome. We see how the trajectory of their civilizations was stopped in one part of Africa by the mighty Kandake queens of Kush, now modern-day Sudan, who literally crushed the head of Augustus Caesar.